Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll talk to Tom Steyer about his new book, Cheaper, Faster, Better: How We'll Win the War on Climate. And we'll meet the founder of Empowerment Avenue, a nonprofit that supports the art of incarcerated people. But first, I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Baldessari, statewide survey director of the Public Policy Institute of California. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Mark.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
So, Mark, you are a leading expert on public opinion, survey methodology, elections, voter behavior. I know you've written a number of books on these topics. So I wanted to start by just asking you about polling methods. Have they changed over the last few election cycles? You know, there's been very famously a lot of discrepancy between the polling that we saw in 2016 with Trump's election and 2020 even, and perhaps even 2022 with the Democrats doing better than expected. I'm wondering if you can just comment on the methodology and how much confidence we can have now and what the polls are telling us about what's coming up for this November election.
Well, thank you for asking. We have learned a lot in the last 8 years about polling methodology. And I think we've grown and improved in our ability to predict elections. But this one will be a challenge, just like 2016 and 2020 was. It's, by all accounts, will be a close election. So my advice is to pay attention to the margin of error. And if the margin of error is 3% and there's a 2-point difference, that means that, you know, we don't know if one side or the other is going to win. That's the challenge with 2016 and 2020. In addition to the polling errors, which we've learned how to make adjustments, we've adjusted our methodology over time as well. We're using online panels in a way that we've found to be very effective in national surveys.
And can you give us a snapshot of who California's likely voters are in November? Any big differences between now and, say, 2020 with the last presidential election?
Well, the electorate keeps growing. Our state, unlike others, has made it possible for people to register. And we've done a good job in registering California adults. We have 22 million registered voters in our state now, 82% of eligible adults. So that number has grown over time. It's not a big change from 2020, but I look at the last 10 years and I'm really impressed with what our state's been able to do, as other states, you know, have not really kept up with how to get people to register to vote. We have automatic voter registration. We've made it easier for people to vote by mail since the pandemic. Now everybody's receiving a vote by mail ballot. So our electorate is looking forward to a very exciting finish to this election.
And Mark, any demographic standouts for our likely voters in November? Breakdowns you want to highlight there?
There are a few things I want to point out. Let's start with the partisan makeup of California voters. Democrats have a 21-point edge over Republicans, 46% Democrat, 25% Republican. The other 3 in 10 are either no party preference or belong to third parties. Our electorate has become more Democratic over time. It's become less conservative than it was 10 years ago. About 3 in 10 voters in our state now describe themselves as conservatives, compared to 4 in 10 10 years ago. Our electorate has become more racially and ethnically diverse. In our estimate of likely voters this time, we expect 50% of the voting population to be white, and 50% to be a combination of Latino, Asian American, African American. That's been a significant change over the past 10 years, the racial and ethnic diversity of our electorate. Still, our electorate does not reflect the racial and ethnic diversity of the state. tends to be older than the general population, tends to be more likely to be homeowners, more likely to be upper income. But our electorate is growing and has become more diverse.
And I'm guessing not much to talk about with Kamala Harris. I'm assuming we're one of the 43 states where the presidential election is basically over. And it sounds like basically what you're saying with the California Senate race, given the Democratic numbers here, that current House member Adam Schiff is likely to prevail over former Dodgers baseball player Steve Garvey. Anything you want to comment about either the presidential election with Kamala Harris or the Senate race with Adam Schiff and Steve Garvey?
The presidential race and the Senate race, we're a blue state. Every presidential and Senate race since 1992 has been won by a Democrat, so we expect that will be the case once again. There's no drama about that. But I do want to point out that there are red parts of our state and there are purple parts of our state that you might not really think about when you're looking at just the overall who's going to win and who's going to lose. And I do want to point out that there were 6 million voters for Donald Trump in mm-hmm. California in 2020, which was numerically more than in any other state of the 50 states, you know, given the size of our electorate. Mm-hmm. And there are parts of our state, the rural northern part of the state, some of the inland parts of the state, that are Republican strongholds. And there are other parts of our state in the Central Valley, in Orange County, San Diego, parts of the Inland Empire, where they're purple. And meaning that the Democrats and Republicans are pretty close in registration, which means that there are about 10 congressional districts out of the 52, which are considered competitive. Those will be closely watched in this upcoming election, because the control of Congress by the Democrats, the Republicans, could be well determined what and by what happens in those 10 districts in California.
And Mark, any of those close to us here in the Bay Area?
I think that I was talking to somebody today about District 13, which was narrowly won by a Republican, which has often been held by a Democrat, which is in the Central Valley, but would be close to us geographically. There are several races in Orange County that are going to be closely watched as well.
And let's talk about some of the statewide ballot measures. There are two bond measures in particular. Proposition 2 would provide $10 billion for educational facilities. Prop 4 would provide $10 billion for climate programs, so-called climate bond. Any thoughts about how Californians might vote on either of these two bond measures?
Well, the bond measures were put on the ballot by the legislature at a time when, the state budget is not providing all the resources for everything that we need, what we want in California. So these were two high priority items, education and climate related issues. Californians narrowly passed Proposition 1, which was a bond measure, in March, but the electorate is very different in the general election. And we'll see how generous people are feeling, but clearly people are recognizing that that there's a need for education funding, and lots of concerns about how resilient we are to climate issues involving water and wildfires in particular.
I also want to ask you about Prop 5, which would lower the threshold from a two-thirds vote to a 55% vote to pass local bonds for things like affordable housing and public infrastructure. It could make a big difference for local governments to raise revenue. What are you thinking about, or what are you seeing in terms of how Prop 5 might fare in November?
Well, when we ask people what's the biggest problem facing the state, the economy comes out first, and affordable housing comes out at close, a second or third. And many people are describing the situation for affordable housing in their communities as a big problem. So this, I think will resonate with voters who are looking at the fact that they'd like to give their local government a little bit more ability to find funds to develop low and middle income housing in California. But it always, changing the vote threshold, in this case, from the supermajority to 55%, it's not that it's never happened. I mean, that the voters passed that for education, local school bonds several years ago. But it's something that people will be looking closely at: who are the opponents and who are the supporters, and what's it going to mean for my community?
Well, a lot more to cover, but we're almost out of time. So I want to ask you about Props 33 and 34. 33 would overturn state law to allow local governments to more easily institute rent control on residential properties. It's pushed forward by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And then meanwhile, there's Prop 34, which seems to be a retaliatory move against the AIDS Healthcare Foundation by the California Apartment Association to prevent that organization from spending money anymore on political causes like this. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you can just talk briefly about those two props before we close here.
So there's been a local rent control measure on the ballot before, a couple of times. And with similar sponsors and similar opponents. And so this, once again, is an issue which comes close to a lot of interest in terms of the voters. And voters will be seeing a lot of commercials for and against Prop 33 and Prop 34, because, as you mentioned, the opponents of Prop 33 are the proponents of Prop 34, and they are, I think seeking to, find a way to make life very difficult for the proponents of rent control, because those proponents will have to both, try to get people to vote no on Prop 34 and yes on Prop 33.
Well, a lot of drama ahead and a lot more we could have covered. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I just want to thank you for joining us, and we'll be covering more of these measures in greater detail in the coming weeks. But thanks so much, as always, for joining us on State of the Bay, Mark Baldessari.
Thank you for inviting me.
And remember, for our listeners, October 21st is the last day to register to vote in this November's election. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to San Francisco's own Tom Steyer. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll explore the question, what are our ideas about wilderness that don't fit into a simple definition?
Our people have been on this landscape for tens of thousands of years and governing ourselves and doing just fine.
It's the next episode of How Wild. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your sonic scavenger. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Our next guest is well known here in San Francisco and around the country as well. Tom Steyer founded Farallon Capital in 1986 and made his investors billions of dollars. He then walked away from Farallon in 2012 and began devoting his time and energy to addressing the climate crisis full time. He started a nonprofit, NextGen, to mobilize youth voters. He then started Tomcat, a regenerative ranch, to prove that raising beef can be compatible with reducing carbon emissions. He's held important state and federal government posts on climate and even ran for president in 2020 on a climate platform. He now runs Galvanize Solutions, a climate investment firm he founded, which funds entrepreneurs working to solve climate problems. And he has a new book out called Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the War, How We'll Win the Climate War, which we'll talk about tonight. So Tom Steyer, welcome to State of the Bay.
Ethan, thank you for having me.
And before we jump into the conversation, I want to invite you, our listeners, to add your questions or comments to the conversation. What would you like to ask Tom Steyer? What are your biggest concerns about the climate crisis? You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So, Tom, since you stepped away from Farallon in 2012, I know you've been incredibly active on the climate front, as I mentioned in the introduction. So I wanted to start by asking you, what motivated you to write this new book that you have out?
Well, Ethan, I really wanted to combat two broadly based memes in our society, both of which I consider to be completely false. One is that we're an oil and gas country. We are the largest producer of oil and gas in the world, by the way. And that we'll always be an oil and gas country. And so let's be adults and deal with it and maximize our profits based on that. That's not true. And the second one is we're in a climate doom loop, that the world is heating up, the air, the water, and it has dramatic repercussions for people around the world, including in California and the United States. And there's nothing we can do about it. It's inevitable. So we might as well just get depressed and, hide in our rooms. That is also completely false. So I wanted to write a much more realistic book about where we are in terms of climate, but also a book that points out that this is a huge challenge for us. It's a huge opportunity for us. And it's one that we are going to solve. We have the ability to solve, and we've just got to make a decision to do it.
Well, your book is, I think, in some ways more than realistic. It's actually quite optimistic. It's really an upbeat book talking about a lot of the successes, a lot of the people who are working day in and day out, innovating to do put forth the solutions that we need to address this crisis. And I'm wondering if you could just talk a bit about where that optimism comes from, why you are so optimistic about our ability to meet this crisis.
Well, one of the things that's true, Ethan, about my day job at Galvanized Climate Solutions is I get a chance to see not just what's possible, but what's happening in the real world. So that is partly about the deployment of existing technologies around the world, but it's also about the development of new innovative technologies. And on both of those scores, I can see real time how much success we're having. I'll just give you a couple, snippets so that you can see what I'm talking about. I mean, for instance, people think that this is an energy transition that's going to happen, and people are predicting it's going to happen, and so maybe it will happen. That's not true. We're in the middle of this transition. In 2023, of the new electricity generation around the world, 86% of it was renewable. We're seeing this all over the world. It's not about the United States. It's all over the world. In 6 months this year, Pakistan delivered renewable energy that is 30% of their total electrical capability. Over 50% of their grid is now renewable. Pakistan. We're seeing this throughout Africa. So there's something. I'll give you one more thing about the deployment right now. People are talking about the slowdown in the growth. It's still growing, but the slowdown in the growth in electric vehicle sales in the United States. And for Americans, we tend to, of course, see the world through the eyes of our country. And I understand that. But we're not the biggest car market in the world. The biggest car market in the world is China. And in July and August, over 50% of the cars sold in China, over a million cars a month, were EVs. In China, they're going to an 80% of new car sales being EVs, like a rocket ship. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the world, the deployment is happening in a very real way. I could give you a bunch more statistics, but this is happening. The other thing that we can see, and I see from my business, is we see people, and there we're predominantly talking about Americans, coming up with very varied, very imaginative, deeply technological changes that let us do everything in a new way. And so just to give you a couple snippets there, I mean, for instance, if you look at how we generate electricity, one of the ways we do it, but a very small part of the generation comes from geothermal. So it's basically the hot water and the steam that's under the earth. And we've traditionally done it from pretty, you know, close to the surface. And I always say to people, it's sort of like Old Faithful in Yellowstone. There's hot water under there and you can turn that into electricity. It's perfectly clean. Well, people now are taking the techniques from oil and gas to go 5,000 feet down. And they're taking the oil and gas rigs to do it. And they're hiring people from the oil and gas industry. And we know this works. It's called enhanced geothermal. We're not sure how much of it there is around the world, although we know there is, that it happens all over the world. And so that's something where you can see, oh, we're going to have baseload electricity generation in a completely clean way. And we're right at the start of it to see how big it's going to be.
So we're speaking with Tom Steyer, the co-founder, I should say, of Galvanized Solutions, a climate investment firm, a former presidential candidate, and author of the new book, Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the Climate War. Now, Tom, I also wanted to ask about how the Bay Area has influenced your thinking on this. How many of these companies are operating here in the Bay Area that you were maybe just describing or that your company is involved in? How has living in this area influenced your thinking about climate that might be reflected in this new book?
Well, let me start by saying, Ethan, I love the Bay Area. When people ask me from around the country how everything is out here, I say same as ever, greatest in the world. Huh. And one of the things that I love about the Bay Area, of a lot of things, one of them is that people are believers in the future and believing we can solve things. So when you look at innovation around the world, people are always surprised that it is disproportionately from the Bay Area. And in this area, in terms of climate and energy innovation, it's disproportionately from the Bay Area because we've got incredible schools here, incredible universities, incredible research facilities and researchers, and we draw in people from all over the world to do it. So it is, you know, there very disproportionate number of these companies come out of the Bay Area. And that's partially because of what I just said. And it's also because, contrary to what our reputation may be, we're totally data-driven. The people around here look at the statistics in everything with a very practical eye and say, okay, I see the problem. Now, what can we do about it? And they bring immense learning and ingenuity to it. And so the Bay Area, to me, is what everybody else in the world is trying to recreate, which is the ability for very talented people to start new things and to basically have, I always say to people, if you're in New York, success looks like being a senior, if in the private sector, success looks like being a senior partner at some huge financial firm that's been around for 100 years. But in the Bay Area, success looks like going into a garage with your best friend and trying to change the world. And we're still doing it, and it's still working, and it's still fantastic.
Well, absolutely. I think the Bay Area has quite a reputation. It's nice to hear you singing its praises because there is so much negative chatter around the doom loop. But I think this is one area where the Bay Area is truly innovative. And when you're looking at an entrepreneur's new idea or a new company that's trying to solve a climate-related problem, is there something specific that you're looking for? How can you? What are the signs that where you can tell that this is looking very
promising? Well, of course, that's a super interesting question for me. So I'm going to give you a little framework for how I think about it, and then I'll tell you what I'm looking for. I mean, I wrote the book and called it Cheaper, Faster, Better because in the energy transition, as in every other economic transformation, it's driven by people's self-interest. You know, people didn't stop using whale oil because they were trying to save whales. They started using fossil fuels because they were cheaper and better. And so I think a lot of times when we talk about the energy transition, people are expecting that the economic decisions are going to be made from a moral standpoint or an environmental standpoint. And overwhelmingly, they're made from an economic standpoint. So let's just say I'm looking at this from a business standpoint, because I believe that that is the framework that's going to let us succeed. Something that is cheaper, that is faster, and that is better. And I could give you real examples, but let's talk. The question you asked me was, what are we looking for? And I think there's a simple way of thinking about this. The first question you have to ask is it a big problem? So if you want to build an important company, you have to be solving an important problem. If you can, you know, it's kind of, if you're going to solve a small problem for a few people, that's not going to be a great or impactful business. So the first question is, how big is the market for it? How big is the problem? The second question is, how good are the people? Because anytime you're starting a new company, they're going to have to make 1,000 decisions that are hopefully going to be good. And whatever they think the world is going to look like, they're going to be wrong, because the world changes and it changes in unpredictable ways. So you're really betting on the people and their ability to adapt to the changes in the world, to, you know, the cliche is to say, to pivot to the new reality. And then the third thing is, why them? You know, why are they going to, you know, do they have a technical capability? What is it about this team or this leadership that has an ability to outcompete everybody else in the world? Because if you have a huge problem, that means a big opportunity. And you have to ask, do they have some technical or educational or experiential advantage over everybody else, which is going to allow them to win? And if you look at the great companies, that's really it's a simple way to think about things, but in my mind, that's how you determine the companies that can really grow, because they're going to be making decisions about things that don't exist in 5 years, and they're going to have to do a good job at it.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and I'm talking to Tom Steyer, who has a new book out called Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the Climate War. And we would love to hear from you as well. What's your biggest concern about the climate crisis? Do you have a question for Tom Steyer about what are some of the growth industries when it comes to clean technology to address the climate crisis? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we do have an email question in for Jen from Mill Valley writes, I was surprised that climate got so little attention during the presidential debate. What do you think it will take to get voters' attention? So Tom, any thoughts on why we're not seeing climate talked about more in this race between Harris and Trump?
Yes. So let's break down why each of the candidates wouldn't be talking that much about climate, or the way really that Vice President Harris is talking about climate. So let's start with the easy fat pitch, which is, why is the Republican candidate not talking about climate? Because he has no knowledge about climate. He has no interest in climate. He has no expertise about climate. He's never studied it. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's proposing things that make no sense, but that he thinks are good for him politically. So, you know, I think in the last Republican administration, they basically not only tried to throw sand into the gears of the energy transition, but they also took us out of the international climate negotiations. And I think that attitude has harmed us. And if you believe what I'm saying, and it is true that we're in the middle of a global energy transition, for the United States to miss that huge economic opportunity is for us to diminish our success, to make ourselves poorer, to make ourselves less significant in the world. I think when you look at how Vice President Harris is talking about climate, she's talking about it primarily in economic terms. And I think what she's trying to do is to meet Americans where they are and to address the issues in the way that they see them. So she's talking about the energy transition in terms of jobs, in terms of growth, in terms of economic leadership in the world, in the things, in the areas where Americans are focused in the short term. And let me take one step back on this, Ethan, just to finish this, and that's this. We are in the middle of an energy transition. We're not in a position where we can stop using fossil fuels today or this month or this year. It's a transition. And so I think that when we think about all the ideas and the proposals that we need to make, you know, pass going forward from a governmental standpoint or the companies we need to build, those are all out in the future. And I think that the political system is dealing this. I think the Democratic Party is talking about this predominantly in a shorter frame, talking more about the economic opportunities. And that's a choice. And that's a belief that that's how we're going to get the most votes and the most opportunity. But I will say Vice President Harris has a long history of being, you know, she is from the Bay Area. She's worked here. She's a Californian. She's been strong on this issue for many years. And the Biden-Harris administration obviously passed the biggest climate bill in the history of the United States by far.
With the Inflation Reduction Act. Absolutely. Well, your book exposes exactly what those who care about the climate crisis are up against in talking about some of the tactics that the fossil fuel industry uses to delay action on climate. You go through some of their history of denying the science, even though they had in-house scientists who knew exactly what was happening. And given the scale, the amount of jobs at stake, the amount of money that they're making by continuing to pull fossil fuels out of the ground and burning it, how can folks who are on the climate side of things, what do you think are the most effective ways that they can help try to rebut some of these arguments that the fossil fuel industry makes and otherwise take on the lobbying might of the fossil fuel industry?
Well, the funny thing, Ethan, is, as I said, that's one of the big reasons I wrote this book, was to say, baloney, we absolutely do not need to give in to fossil fuels going forward. And so let me just give you a couple ways that we're getting, there's so many ways that they're under attack. For starters, they're under attack by technologies that are cheaper and better. So for instance, not everybody knows this. Many people in the United States believe that fossil fuels are cheaper than renewable energy. So just to be clear, if we were to put out a request for bids to produce electricity, by far the two cheapest sources of electricity in the United States are solar and wind, by far. That's why Texas has tripled its amount of solar since 2018. Texas added more renewable power in last year than any other state by far. They produce a lot more wind than any other state by far. So the first thing that fossil fuel that we can do is simply look at the facts and understand that technology and that across the board, we're winning. That it's cheaper to do renewable energy, that batteries have gone down 80%. They'll go down another 80% this decade. That EVs are going to be cheaper to buy, cheaper to maintain, cheaper to fill up. That in fact, they are under attack because their products are too expensive and too dirty. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you know, I think that as people experience the impact of climate change and how will they experience it, I think we tend to think about this as the experience will be a physical experience. Your house will burn down. Your house will be flooded. It will be so hot that you can't go outside, or you feel, if you have an outdoor job, you feel really bad about it. You can't go outside to exercise. We think that it's going to be physical things. And those things are happening, and we can see them and we can talk about them, and they're in the news. But the other thing that's happening, and it's happening in California, but it's happening across the country, is this is impacting people financially. And the most obvious way this is happening is the increased cost of home insurance, which is, you know, if an insurance company is going to write you insurance that your house doesn't burn down and the chance of your house burning down goes way up, the insurance costs a lot more. And that's happening in Florida, in California all the time. And if there's a chance of a huge hurricane ruining your house, then they're going to charge you a lot more for home insurance. That then plays into, but there's expensive insurance and then there's no insurance. There's no price at which they're willing to write insurance. And that is happening around the country. And if you can't get home insurance, you can't get a mortgage, because mortgages tend to be multi-year, up to 30 years. And no bank is going to lend you 90% of the cost of a house. And then if the house burns down or is flooded out, they're on the hook. You have to have homeowners insurance. And so if you can't get homeowners insurance, you can't get a mortgage, you can't sell your house. And for most Americans, their biggest savings account is their house. So when you think about the impacts of what's going on as this is driven home, then people's feelings about the people who are causing it to happen, and 3/4 of CO2 emissions of carbon pollution is coming from the burning of fossil fuels. And so I think that they're in a very tough spot where they're trying to sell a product that is more expensive than competing products and increasingly more expensive. And they're trying to also sell a product which has, you know, some terrible impacts on other people. And so I think that they're rightfully, they should be very nervous, and people who are investing should be taking into account that, you know, these are companies that are really under the gun, are really trying to hang on to something from the past. And that's not the way the world's moving.
So it's kind of the flip side of the negative impacts of all these extreme weather events, the changing climate, that it's building in potentially some political support for some of the policies that you talk about and the business opportunities you talk about in your book. I did want to flag another email that we got in from Isabel in Marin County, who writes, what communication tools have you found to be the most effective in getting people to care about the climate? Is there a specific rhetoric that you found helpful in engaging people? And Tom, I know this is something that you did write about in your book, just some of the different turns of phrases that those in the climate space should be thinking about. Can you talk a bit more about communications?
Well, you know, I've spent a lot of time trying to figure this out, Ethan, over the last 15 plus years. And, you know, to a very large extent, I'm talking about it from an economic standpoint, and I'm talking about it from an opportunity standpoint, because I think it's just so dispiriting for everybody to get into that doom loop. The truth is, it is a real challenge, and the news from the natural world is worse than most people know and worse than the scientists predicted, for sure. But the news from the tech world and the business world and the finance world is way better than anybody ever expected or knew. So when I talk about it, I like people to think, okay, it's a problem. Americans have had problems before, and we've solved them. Since when did we get so scared that we're not willing to face up to and address our big problems? And this, in my mind, is a gigantic opportunity for Americans to come together and remember how powerful we are when we're together. And, you know, obviously, I mean, I was listening to your show before I got on, and, you know, how divided the country is, how disparate the feelings are between Democrats and Republicans, and kind of a lot of the emotion around that. And I think it's important to remember that when we've solved problems, we've done it together. Democrats are not solving this problem. Americans are solving this problem. This is a society-wide thing. Republicans are smart. They know this is a problem. The Republican leadership doesn't want to face up to that, but Republican voters know that. And if you poll them, you will see that they know that. So when I talk about it, it's like, I see this. Let's see it as an opportunity. Let's go after it. Let's go after it together. Let's not insist that everybody go after it for the same reason. Let's not ask people to give, you know, to apologize or anything. Let's go after it together and solve this as Americans, and remember how good that's going to feel to solve a huge world problem, to do it together, and remember what this country was, you know, what the original idea of this country was, which was to lead the world in every way.
Galvanize Solutions, former presidential candidate and author of the new book, Cheaper, Faster, Better, How We'll Win the Climate War. I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to State of the Bay on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tom, we only have a couple minutes left, but I did want to touch on a pretty big theme throughout your book, which is the importance of people who have the ability and the means to consider dedicating their careers full-time to fighting climate change and making this their cause. And you talk about how you made that decision. And of course, this isn't really feasible or practical for many people, but I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about what's behind that plea in your book for people to consider doing that, and a little bit about how that kind of individual action, how that matters versus systemic reform.
Well, let me say this, what I was talking about in the book, and I was really asking people to take it into consideration in all aspects of their lives, because I view this as, if we get this right, we're going to get everything right. If we don't destroy the natural world, we're going to build a world for Americans and for people around the world that is better than any of us can imagine, honestly. And so what I was really talking about climate people, and I was saying you don't have to become a climate advocate to be a climate person. If you're a banker, please take into account climate in the way you do your business. If you're a screenwriter, please think about it in terms of when you're writing, you know, for movies or plays or TV shows. It doesn't mean you have to change what you love to do and what you're good at and what you want to do. All it means is you take it into consideration. And you take it into consideration when you vote, you take it into consideration with what you buy. And the comparison that I used was to World War II, where it really took an all of society effort and people expected each other to show up. That it wasn't okay for you to shirk your responsibility to the other people in the country who were showing up. That in fact, everybody knew we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to do it together. And that means everybody's expected to pay their part, and their friends and relatives and community members are going to look to them and ask, what did you do? And that might be having a victory garden where you grew food so that we could send more food to the troops overseas. And it could be volunteering, and it could be voting, but basically everybody was expected to show up. And then as a result, we not only won the war, we really changed ourselves and we changed the world. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have a chance to do here if we're willing to accept that level of responsibility for a challenge that is at least that deep, that is very, very serious, but it is also the opportunity for us to be the country and the people that we want to be and that I really believe that we are and that we have been for hundreds of years. So I see it as an immense opportunity for us all to remember how smart, how hardworking, how patriotic the people are in different parts of the country who may belong to different political parties, but to remember that in fact, we're all trying to push the same place in different ways. And why don't we get together and use this problem as a way of coming together and reminding ourselves what success looks like, how fun it is to win. If you've played sports and you've been on teams, it's really, really fun to be on a winning team. And everybody on a winning team loves each other. And that's what Absolutely. We need to go back to doing. And this is our chance.
Well, such a good reminder about what's at stake and what the possibilities are. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on the new book, Cheaper, Faster, Better. I definitely commend it to listeners. And Tom Steyer, thank you for joining us on State of the Bay.
Ethan, once again, thank you for having me.
And just a note to our listeners, Tom will be appearing this Thursday evening at Book Passage in Corte Madera. We'll have a link to his book on the KALW website as well. Coming up after the break, The Art of the Incarcerated. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area and online at kalw.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan, and tonight we're joined by Oakland resident Rahsaan Thomas. He's the executive director of Empowerment Avenue and also an award-winning artist and co-host of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated podcast, Ear Hustle. He's also featured in the documentary What These Walls Won't Hold, which was awarded a top prize at the San Francisco International Film Festival. And Thomas accomplished all this while incarcerated at San Quentin. He was paroled in 2023 and now works to promote the artistic endeavors of people housed in prisons through his nonprofit, Empowerment Avenue. Welcome to State of the Bay, Rahsaan.
Thank you. Thank you, Babin.
So I wanted to start with what art means for you. I mean, you started this nonprofit to help other people who come from similar situations as you. But in your own life, what has art meant for you and done for you?
Art is healing. It's a way to make beauty out of chaos. It's also a path to proximity and change and growth and now economic empowerment.
I think that's so true that it takes chaos and makes beauty. How did you discover that you were an artist?
That's a great question. When I was a kid, I used to doodle on all my homework, all my notebooks. I would like make these superhero characters, just doodle away. And so my mom took me to art classes at Brooklyn College, even though I was like in junior high at the time. This was just trying to encourage that artistic side. But when I got there, there was guys that were so incredibly talented, I got intimidated. Like, never really followed through, never went back. But when I was incarcerated, like, writing was a necessity. There's like no way around writing because nobody's coming to save you. So you got to file your own appeal. You can't use the phone for months at a time. So you got to write letters. And I also envisioned that if I could become a writer, I can have a positive impact for prison and make my sons proud of me, even if I never went home.
Tell me about the inspiration behind Empowerment Avenue. Can you share where the idea came from?
Yeah, it started with just a need, a need that needed to be filled because I felt like I was in a prison that, like, you know, a lot of labels, and we ran around with like little supervision. You had to be in your cell at certain times, like count time and night time. But other than that, you can go in and out. So anyway, even though all these labels, all these people who committed crimes that were like either three strikes or actually really violent crimes, it still was one of the safest places I'd ever been. And so I felt like I had solutions to gun violence and, you know, drug addiction and all these solutions, but society wasn't listening to us because we caused harm and we weren't valued as experts in these fields. And so I had a lot to write about, and I felt like writing for the San Quentin was awesome, but like, I feel like I was preaching to the choir. I feel like the paper that just went to the same other incarcerated people, went to other prisons and just social justice advocates. They didn't get past the choir. So I longed for a way to get my voice in bigger spaces. And I also wanted to make enough money to at least take care of myself. I was like a 40-year-old man asking my mommy to send me a package, right? Like, needing deodorant, toothpaste, stuff the state didn't provide. And so I wanted to, like, you know, be able to take care of myself and hopefully help take care of my kids. And so it just was a necessity. And so I started trying to write for outside publications. And, you know, I needed places that were male friendly, and there weren't that many. A typical requirement is to submit through something called Submittable. And I can't do Submittable for my cell, or I can't even do email. And so I didn't have a way to like use, you know, there's no Microsoft Word, there's no editing software, there's no track changes. All that was beyond me. And so I needed some help. And I noticed a friend of mine was getting published left and right. And the difference between me and him, besides him being a slightly better writer, is he had help. He had an editor that was editing his pieces, pitching them for him, doing the email, doing the Submittable. And so he was getting published left and right. And so I was looking for that, not only for myself, but I felt like there were a lot of great writers in San Quentin that were starting a breakthrough. A renaissance was happening, and I wanted to help facilitate that renaissance. And I got lucky. I happened to meet Emily Nanko at a breast cancer walk, and she came in to also do a story on San Quentin News. And when she got to see the level of journalism, she thought that we belong in a bigger pile. And she added on her heart to want to help that process. And I was like, well, I'm glad I met you. And George Floyd was martyred, and it created this storm. And then COVID, you know, COVID hit first, then George Floyd was martyred. Then the prison went on lockdown for COVID. And like, all these things made it so that the demand for incarcerated voices was up. And people had a lot of time to volunteer and really want to help. They really, you know, it was like a racial reckoning right there, right? Where people could not deny the structural issues in our systems anymore. And so Emily put a call out on social media to our writers group who wants to help partner, pair up with incarcerated writers to do the editing, to do the Submittable for them. And like 100 people said yes. We launched, I think we started a soft launch with like maybe 20 writers to see if it would work. And it worked very well. We hit the New York Times 3 times. I hit Boston Globe personally, NBC Insider, High Country. I mean, I published 42 articles and stories in 31 months. And the guys behind me are excelling. They're going past me. We got people with fellowships, books in the works, like just all kind of, it's beyond my wildest dreams, like art shows, solo exhibits. And now we're co-directing and co-producing films with incarcerated people. It's really beyond my wildest dream.
I mean, your journalistic resume is something that people dream of. I mean, whether you are incarcerated or not. So there are kind of two tracks to your program. There's Writers for Liberation. And as you pointed out, there are about 20 to 25 people in it. And all of these writers are earning money, right? This isn't just something to spend your time on. You really are hoping to create writers who can sustain themselves.
Yeah, and that's so important to me because my father was incarcerated and he was on drugs and he died when I was young. And all that time, my mother took care of me. And so she had to be the mother and the father. That means working overtime, working doubles, but also means she's not there. We're latchkey kids. And that happened because that income is missing and that person is missing. So double the issue. So I figured, like, if I could have made enough money, if I had this program when I first got incarcerated, how much impact could I have on my kids' life? Right? How can we break those cycles of poverty and intergenerational incarceration? And so I feel like, you know, this program is necessary. And it's also your self-esteem, man. Like, if you can't take care of yourself, how low do you feel, you know? And how is that helping anybody do anything, you know? And so, yeah, I feel like the economic component is very important.
I wanted to talk about another component of Empowerment Avenue and let people know about it. It's a visual arts program. So similar to the writing, it's artists who are currently housed in prisons, and you're trying to help push their work out as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that started because I was watching nonprofits take the art of incarcerated people and give it away or sell it for like $150, $250 and keep it as a fundraiser for the nonprofit. And I'm like, okay, that's beautiful, right? Guys inside want to help different causes. But like, should we test the value of the artist? You're just giving the things away. I just felt like the artists around me were worth so much more than that. And so I wanted to like step in and help them find their value. In fact, I bought a couple of paintings while I was incarcerated. Guys I think are going to make me a millionaire one day. I'm just waiting. Got the painting in storage, just waiting for my time. It's my retirement plan. This makes up for that 401k I didn't have. Right. And so I was really, truly, literally invested in the success of these artists. And chance gave me a chance to do something about it. Just chance. Just God is the greatest. And the first, a lady named Jo Crowder from Flyaway Productions, she reached out and said she was looking for a Black organizer to help her do an art/aerial dancing event dedicated to Blacks and Jews teaming up against mass incarceration. And I'm like, what the heck, yeah, you know, because already I'm a huge Circus of Soleil fan, even though I've never been. And I already had in my heart mind that these artists need a way to get to more. And then this opportunity fell out the sky. And so we started planning this event. And I didn't even know that then I would be a curator. I just one day they started asking me questions about writing a curator statement and what I want to name the exhibit. And which artist did I want? And how did I want this? And I'm like, why do they keep asking me all these questions? They're the museum people. I didn't realize what I signed up for. And so it turned out to be this amazing event. And we asked for each artist to be paid just to be in the exhibit, which was new because a lot of times exhibits just mean you get your works up seen. But I felt like we needed more than that. And they agreed. And ever since then, every exhibit we've been in, the artists have been paid just being in the exhibit. And then we use the momentum and the press from the exhibit to try to sell the art. We usually sell, you know, most of it, a lot of it. We never sell all. We're waiting for that day. But we're selling at way better price points than 50 to 100, right? And I'm just trying to see how far we can push the envelope on what the art of incarcerated people can be viewed as being worthy of.
Well, there's an exhibit coming up, and it's entitled Painting Ourselves into Society, which I think is a prompt that you came up with while you were incarcerated. So tell us where we could find that exhibit and what's a piece that we can't miss.
Yeah, you could find that exhibit at the Berkeley Art Center. The opening is September 21st, and the Berkeley Art Center, I believe, is located at 1275 Walnut Street in Berkeley. And a piece you can't miss, Alvin Smith. He painted this lady in a women's prison who's incarcerated, painting an image of herself on the streets voting. And it's amazing.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us on State of the Bay, Rahsaan. It was such a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you too. And again, thank you for having me.
To learn more about Rahsaan Thomas and his nonprofit, Empowerment Avenue, check out their website, www.empowermentav.org. And don't forget to see the exhibit, which opens on September 21st at Berkeley Art Center, located at 1275 Walnut Street in Berkeley. Again, it's called Painting Ourselves into Society.
All right, that was my co-host, Grace Wan, and that's it for State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us again next Monday at 6. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper and Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.